threat, Reacher said.
Against your daughter?
Reacher said nothing. Mahmoud said,
You're going to show me how to arm, little Wing.
Reacher glanced at the U-Haul.
I can't. All you have are the electronics.
The missiles are on their way, Mahmoud said. They'll be here very soon.
Where are you going to use them?
Here and there.
Inside the United States?
Ah, it's a target-rich environment.
Lamazon said Kashmir.
We might ship some units to select friends.
We're
a big organization.
I won't do it.
Oh, you will. Like you did before. For the same reason.
Reacher paused a beat and said,
You better come in.
He stepped aside. Mahmoud was accustomed to deference, so he squeezed past and walked ahead into the hallway. Reacher hit him hard in the back of the head and sent him stumbling toward the living room door, where Francis Nagley stepped out and dropped him with a neat uppercut. A minute later, he was hog-tied on the hallway floor with one figure-eight cable tie binding his left wrist to his right ankle and another binding his right wrist to his left ankle. The ties were zipped hard, and the flesh around them was already swelling. Mahmoud was bleeding from the mouth and moaning. Reacher kicked him in the side and told him to shut up. Then he stepped back into the living room and waited for the truck from Denver. The truck from Denver was a white 18-wheeler. Its driver was hog-tied next to Mahmoud a minute after climbing down from the cab. Then Reacher dragged Mahmoud out of the house and left him face up in the sun next to his U-Haul. Mahmoud's eyes were full of fear. He knew what was heading his way. Reacher figured he would prefer to die, which was why he left him there alive. O'Donnell dragged the driver out and dumped him next to his truck. They all stood for a moment and looked around one last time and then crammed themselves into Nagley's Civic and headed south, fast. As soon as cell coverage kicked in, they stopped, and Nagley called her Pentagon buddy. 7 o'clock in the west, 10 in the morning in the east. She told the guy where to look and what he would find. Then they drove on. Reacher watched out the back window, and before they even hit the mountains, he saw a whole squadron of choppers heading west on the horizon. Bell AH-1s from some nearby homeland security base, he assumed. The sky was thick with them. After the mountains, they talked about money. Nagley gave Dixon the financial instruments and the diamonds, and they all agreed she should carry them back to New York and convert them to cash. First call would be to repay Nagley's expense budget. Second call would be to set up trust funds for Angela and Charlie Franz and Tammy Orozco and her three children and Sanchez's friend Milena. And the third call would be to make one last donation to People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals in the name of Tony Swan's dog, Maisie. Then it got awkward. Nagley was okay for salary, but Reacher sensed that Dixon and O'Donnell were hurting. Hurting and tempted, but sensitive about asking. So he went ahead and admitted he was flat broke, and suggested they take whatever little margin was left over and divide it up four ways between themselves as wages. Everyone agreed. After that, they didn't talk much at all. Lamazon was gone. Mahmoud was in the system, but no one had come back. And Reacher had gotten around to asking himself the big question. If the stalled car and the 210 had not delayed his arrival at the hospital, would he have performed any better than Dixon, or O'Donnell, than Swan, or Franz, or Sanchez, or Orozco? Maybe the others were asking themselves the same question about him. Truth was, he didn't know the answer, and he hated not knowing. 2 hours later, they were at LAX. They abandoned the Civic in a fire lane and walked away from it, heading for different terminals and different airlines. Before they split up, they stood on the sidewalk and bumped fists one last time and said goodbyes they promised would be temporary. Nagley headed inside to American. Dixon went looking for American West. O'Donnell searched for United. Reacher stood in the heat with anxious people swirling all around him and watched them walk away. Reacher left California with close to $2,000 in his pocket from the dealers behind the Wax Museum in Hollywood and from Seropian in Vegas and from the two guys at New Age's place in Highland Park. As a result, he didn't run low on cash for almost 4 weeks. Finally, he stopped by an ATM in the bus depot in Santa Fe, New Mexico. As always, he worked out his balance first, and then checked to see if the bank's calculation matched his own. For the second time in his life, it didn't. The machine told him that the balance in his account was more than $100,000 bigger than he was expecting. Exactly, $111,822.18 bigger, according to his own blind calculation. 111,822.18. Dixon, obviously. The spoils of war. At first he was disappointed, not with the amount. It was more money than he had seen in a long time. He was disappointed with himself because he couldn't perceive any message in the number. He was sure Dixon would have adjusted the total by a few dollars or cents one way or the other to give him a wry smile, but he couldn't get it. It wasn't prime. No even number greater than 2 could be prime. It had hundreds of factors. Its reciprocal was boring. Its square root was a long, messy string of digits. Its cube root was worse. 111822218. Then he grew disappointed with Dixon. Because the more he thought about it, the more he analyzed it, the more he was sure it really was a boring number. Dixon's head wasn't in the game. She had let him down. Maybe. Or maybe not. He pressed the button for the mini-statement. A slip of thin paper came out of a slot. Faint gray printing. The last 5 transactions against his account. Nagley's original deposit from Chicago was still there, first on the list. Then second, his $50 withdrawal at the Portland bus depot up in Oregon. Then third, his airfare from Portland to LAX way back at the beginning. Then fourth, a new deposit in the sum of $101,810.18. Then fifth, on the same day, another deposit in the sum of $10,012 exactly. 10181018 10012. He smiled. Dixon's head was in the game after all. Totally, completely in the game. The first deposit was 1018. Repeated for emphasis. Military police radio code for mission accomplished. Twice over. 1018. 1018. Herself and O'Donnell rescued. Or Lamazon and Mahmoud beaten. For both things. Nice, Carla, he thought. The second deposit was her zip code. 10012, Greenwich Village, where she lived. A geographic reference, a hint. She had asked, feel like dropping by New York afterward? He smiled again and balled up the slip of thin paper and dropped it in the trash. Took $100 from the machine and headed on inside the depot and bought a ticket for the first bus he saw. He had no idea where it was going. He had answered, I don't make plans, Carla. This is Dick Hill, We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Bad Luck and Trouble by Lee Child. This program was produced and directed by Dick Hill. Executive producer, Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2007 by Lee Child. Production copyright 2007, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.